Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, welcome, welcome to the French Connections Tuesday edition. Today's date is the 16th day of November, 2010. Of course, my name is Daryl Bradford Smith. Great to have you here for another important broadcast. A lot of things happening as usual. We are watching the European Union's financial system come under the same pressures as the United States' system with and clandestine quantitative easing taking place. That is to say, they're printing money hand over fist to try to bail out the weakest members of the EU, including Portugal and Ireland. And, of course, Spain is coming up next. France is in a big mess, $785 billion in debt. We've got problems across the world here. And they've been, most of that money has been stolen, siphoned off. A lot of it is sitting in the accounts of the people we're going to talk about today, of course. But you know, one of the things that we often have brought up on this programming is the connection in the past to the drug peddling that went on in the East India Company and the heroin and at the time opium sales that were going on during the 1820s through that whole century. A lot of opium was developed into different drugs as well, such as laudanum, which they were selling to women across the United States. White women were being sold this for what they called the vapors, but they were selling this drug to everybody and in fact were making a fortune on it. They forced it on China, where they were consuming huge sums of Indian-grown opiums, and then over this last 100 years, through the last period of growth, they were actually growing it in China under the communist regime. In fact, there were hundreds of thousands of hectares of opium poppy fields being grown in China. They have shifted that in large part now to Afghanistan. Of course, Afghanistan is producing all this. Why am I bringing that up? Because drug sales are a tax-free way for these criminals to finance themselves and allow themselves to get political activities started in countries around the world. They use it to fill their coffers flush with cash, destabilize nations, sicken people. And as you're going to hear today from my guest, Nancy Turner Banks, MD, they have used it to sell the idea that AIDS in the United States is caused by a virus, when in fact a lot of it came on the heels of the cocaine epidemic, which is the drug that they've begun to really push out into the public, especially since it turned into crack cocaine. The use of cocaine itself has always been addictive. I remember back in the early 80s, they used to write articles saying that cocaine had no addictive properties, which was the biggest nonsense you could have ever imagined, especially if you were somebody that ever tried the stuff. You know darn well it's addictive. But they've always used things such as tobacco as well. There are so many addictive drugs out there in the world that people will gravitate toward. But the end result has been that the population, especially in the poorest areas of the United States, Canada, Britain, and Europe, have been decimated with the abuse of drugs. And now they've used it to morph it into a sickness. And even though they have never isolated the AIDS virus, they are causing people to die because of the treatment for a fictitious disease. So we're going to bring Nancy up right away here and bring out some of these facts. Nancy, are you with me?
Yes, Daryl. How are you today?
I'm doing great, Nancy. You know, we talk a little bit in your book, especially it starts in chapter 10 for those of you who haven't read this book. And I've got to tell everyone out there, this is an incredible read. And there's so much information in it. And it's so logical. And it's so well cited. It's Nancy, the information you're bringing out in here has been well known to me. There were no surprises in your book for me because I've been doing this stuff for a long time. But The entire story in one sitting, one place, that's new. You know, a lot of the people have done bits and parts of this conspiracy, and you did a great job of bringing together a lot of disparate facts and put it all in one place and make a seamless story out of it with citing and with good referencing. So I my hat's off to you. Kudos for the great effort you made. This thing about the neighborhood destruction. Now, we know pretty well here that as the black community began to get decimated by the drugs in the 1960s and 70s, because it started earlier than most people believe, with the returning soldiers coming in on heroin from Vietnam, we always have known that much of the destruction of the family and the social ills that hit the black community were always going to visit the white community in a few years. It's always been like a test community for these criminals to poison the community you're from before they got to the others. And they did that quite well with this. And of course, we saw the first crack cocaine epidemic hit in the 80s. And of course, it toward the end of the 80s, it was in every community. So you want to give us an overview of what you discovered in your research and how this kind of fits together with history?
Yeah, well, the reason I started looking at the opium issue is because another well-known scientist by the name of Peter Duisberg had written a book about the AIDS crisis, and Peter is a virologist, and he looked at it, and he said, you know, they are misdiagnosing this thing. This is a subset of the drug crisis. And so the people that they are seeing are toxic on drugs. And so I, as a physician, when I heard that, I said, okay, that's interesting. And I had also been looking at the drug issue because, as you have indicated, drugs are a very big problem in the African American community. So I really, when he said drugs, I had to start looking at how were drugs changed in Western life. What part did drugs play in developing the Western economic system? And so I had to take it back to the British East India Company and the trade that they developed with China. And so what I discovered at a very high level, both the international peddlers and the elite of Europe, especially Britain and the United States, were involved very early on in the drug trade. Yep. And because there was, they were, especially the British, they were losing their silver. Yep. They had a trade imbalance.
Yep.
And so they wanted to study that trade imbalance, and they hit upon the idea of selling opium because the Dutch had already done that in Malaysia successfully. And so the British decided to do it in a much bigger market, of course, which was China.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was very successful. And so the elites of the United States and Britain learned some very valuable lessons from using this drug out of its cultural context. Because historically, every culture has used some sort of drug for medicinal or religious purposes. But the drugs always had a cultural context. They were never used as a commodity or as a method to destabilize the society. So this was a new phenomena, using a drug for a commodity and for a societal destabilization. And that's what the British did effectively to China. How do we take this society down? How do we weaken it? How do we take it over? And so they basically dragooned the several areas of India, Bengal and Bihar provinces.
Yep. Yep.
and made the people start cultivating opium, and then they pushed this horrible drug into China, and they fought two wars. They effectively had the entire British Empire involved in fighting these wars for their commodity exchange.
Yeah. Yeah.
So these people learned, and so they knew that this drug was addictive. They knew that because it was addictive, people would do anything to get it, and so that it was going to bring them a lot of money because you had repeat customers. Three, it would destabilize families and destabilize communities, because when you have a member of your family who's addicted, you know, if you're the wife, you don't have the money. If you're the child, you're hungry. And if you're the local police, you have people stealing. So it totally destabilizes families and communities.
Yeah. Well, I have a question for you.
It's highly profitable.
It is. And I have a question because you bring this up in the book. the nature of opiates on the human body are destructive to the immune system taken in large doses. In other words, what you write in the book is that opiates attack your ability to fight and ward off disease. And is that true?
Yes, they've known that. I went back to the literature, and I looked at the literature from over 100 years. For over 100 years in the medical literature, it was known that opiates depress the immune system, that they increase the number of infections that people have, and people and also they're carcinogenic. So that was known in the medical literature. And, of course, these elites control the medical industry, so they have access to this information. Mm-hmm. So when they began to import these drugs in greater quantities into the West, it was already known that what these drugs had the potential to do when they were going to be used in large quantities in a large population of people.
Well, now, isn't it true that back in the 1880s and after the Civil War, there was a big push on to use opiates for a whole host of ailments, and they were giving it to actually middle class and upper class women to get rid of their agita and their what they called the vapors at the time, and they had half of the middle class of America addicted to laudanum, didn't they?
Well, I think they attempted in the last century to bring opium into the United States. And they brought, because remember, labor was quite cheap during and after the Civil War because of slavery, and because of slavery, it kept everybody's wages down. But they imported the Chinese, many of whom were addicted to opium, and so they began to sell it also into the dominant community, and many women they sold it as patent as medicine, but you didn't really need a prescription, and many people started having access to it. But the important thing about America at that time is that they still had the moral courage to ban this product. Mm-hmm. They knew what it was doing to the communities, and they had the moral courage to ban it.
Yeah. Well, now let's kind of move in time up to the present, or up to about 40 years ago, 30 years ago, when we had Vietnam underway, and we of course they used to talk a lot about Air America and the Golden Triangle and all this other stuff. What they weren't saying at the time was that the largest producer of opiates was not Burma or the Golden Triangle, but in fact it was still China. The production of opiates shifted to Communist China after the Second World War, and they earmarked tens and hundreds of thousands of acres of land to grow opium and then move it into the West. Am I correct?
Right. Both the Chiang Kai-shek and Mao Zedong were financing their armies with opium.
Yeah.
And so it didn't really matter to the West who won that battle, because either of them would be involved in the opium trade. But this is also an important thing that people fail to remember. Many of the same families who were in the opium trade became the families who started the organizations, the clandestine agencies in the West, yes. The MI6 and the CIA. Yes. One of the families that I traced, of course, was the Dulles family.
Yes.
And so this tendency for these clandestine agencies to be involved in this trade is goes back several hundred years and goes back intergenerational.
Well, we also see the Jewish family Sassoon being partnered with the American family, the Delanos. And, of course, anybody who knows FDR, the D stands for the Delano family. And so FDR's family was an opium dealer, not dissimilar from John F. Kennedy's father being a bootlegger. I mean, a lot of these big fortunes were made during times of illegal distribution of product, and I mean, alcohol again is a drug, no different than tobacco being a drug, no different than so we go back and we see a lot of these rich families that are still holding sway in the world made their fortunes through addiction, And I mean, you go back to the Reynolds family with cigarettes and Marlboros and the rest of it, and all of this other stuff. They've always used this as a tool of wealth and control. So, what kinds of things do we see leading up to the 1960s as far as drugs? Because I know the Americans were not the main repository for drug profits early on. There were some, you know, anybody who knows about Billie Holiday's history, of course, the jazz groups were, and the singers were kind of into the drug. But the mass population had not been affected by it in large measure. When did that really change?
Well, first of all, I also the thing that I think I want Americans to realize that several major corporations in this country got their start because of the drug industry. For example, many of the railroads, AT&T, and some other major corporations used the venture capital from drug money. Also, several of the East Coast universities, Harvard, Princeton, Columbia, and Yale, were financed quite a bit through drug money. So drug money has been a hidden part of the East Coast elite from the very beginning. Now, one of the things that the CIA and many of these elite came out of Yale and Harvard, which is not unsurprising. However, they started after the Second World War, they imported a lot of Nazi scientists into the United States, and some of them went into psychiatric institutions where they began to experiment with various drugs, mind-altering drugs such as LSD. And the federal government was even financing these drug ventures. And they began in the 50s and 60s, they began releasing these drugs into the jazz scene, the beatnik scene, and the artist scene. And so those drugs began in the 50s and 60s to begin to permeate the society. And then after the Vietnam War, when the soldiers came back from Vietnam, that's basically when the drug industry exploded in the United States.
Well, I have to admit that my generation was took the brunt of that victimization, and I saw that drug availability was absolute in every community in America. And I mean, of course, a lot of kids of my generation chose not to use drugs, and a lot did, but it was certainly not because of lack of availability, certainly.
But remember, you had people like Timothy Leary, who was supposedly this Harvard professor who was going around the country experimenting with LSD, and so he was supposed to be an adult and a stable kind of person, and yet he was somebody who was promoting this use of drugs.
Yeah.
And so the middle class white students at these major universities began to think, oh, well, if these professors are doing it, it must be okay.
Well, the other thing was that they saw a growing resistance to what they were doing in Vietnam. And what they were basically doing in Vietnam is hiving off and sucking out assets and profits out of the United States into their military industrial complex, making sure that they could have a good cash flow. And at the same time, they were never allowing the American troops to win a war that was not designed to be won. In fact, the Chinese, were being provided with all the means they needed to support Vietnam in that war, and we weren't allowed to win anything. We were allowed to win a few battles, but the war was out of reach for winning. And so ultimately the demise of the troops there and their leaving in 1975 was a foregone conclusion even at the beginning, I would imagine.
The other thing that I think people don't realize is there has been a fifth column in the United States that has been writing, from the Council on Foreign Relations to people like Henry Kissinger.
Yes.
And this professor at Columbia by the name of Gardner.
Yep.
They've been writing for years about how you undermine a country like the United States and how you demoralize it. So a lot of these wars were never designed to be, I don't believe they were designed to be won. I think they were part of the beginning of the demoralization and the deindustrialization of the United States, as had been talked about in these high-level documents.
Yeah, and And it's interesting, Nancy, because what we see is a multi-pronged approach into America. And as I stated earlier, the black community was the first community under attack. And back in the 1940s and 50s, the black communities across America had strong families. There was father, mother, aunts and uncles in the neighborhood. There was, you know, jobs, working. I mean, this was not a Norman Rockwell setting, but certainly there were strong church values and strong, you know, the whole undercurrent of quality family life was still very center stage during that period. And as soon as these opened the floodgates of this policy change, and it just didn't come with drugs. It came with, the birth control pill was part of it. I mean, all kinds of stuff happened in a 10 or 15 year period. It was absolutely a death knell for these communities. Could you talk a little bit about what happened during that period?
Well, after the civil rights movement, there was a fear that the black communities had very strong family units and they were very strong culturally, because during the time of segregation, the black community, the people who were in the middle class and the upper middle class, basically lived with the working class people. So these communities were very cohesive.
Yeah.
And so the idea was to move the upper and middle classes away from the working classes and then to begin to divide and separate these communities and to put the lower class communities under attack, which they did. And the Rand Institute actually wrote several position papers, and they called it they wanted to decentralize these communities because of the political power that they saw that these communities could have.
And the power they had, Nancy, was like they acted as a wedge group. In other words, the two-party system has always worked in favor of these criminals, of these controllers. And when the black community started flexing its political muscle, they were able to be issue orientated and sway a direction one or the other by putting their support behind somebody. So they needed to make sure that group could not be instrumental in changing the political landscape.
Exactly. So they concocted these ideas of how to attack this community.
Yeah.
And so what they did is, especially in the urban areas, they began to withdraw services from the areas. They began to bring in drugs. They began to release people from psychiatric institutions and put them on the street. And of course, they went to the poorest areas. They began to decrease the fire department and the police services. So, and then of course, they crowded people into apartments that, formerly might have held one family. Now they would break those apartments up into smaller units, and now three families might live in an apartment that might have one family. So you had this increased crowding. So you had all of the elements there for neighborhood destruction. And the neighborhoods did, and of course, that was a time after desegregation that people who could afford to move out of these neighborhoods, who were the more stabilizing influences in the neighborhoods, began to move out of the neighborhoods. So you had all of the elements for neighborhood deterioration.
Yeah.
And with the addition of bringing the drugs in to those neighborhoods and selling the drugs to those neighborhoods, that was just the last straw.
Well,
then there were other elements to that. Of course, the welfare issue that came in that sort of condemned the men from being in the households.
Yep.
So there were many, many factors coming in to sort of destabilize these neighborhoods.
Well, I call it the process of ghettoizing these areas. Now, they've never been the upper crust areas, but at the same time, they were always functional and they were always cared about by their residents and clean. And I brought up with you privately, I think about a week ago, we were talking about the Bronx specifically. And how I remember as a kid traveling through the area and going into Brooklyn, but seeing the area as an inner city area, not dissimilar from where I was from in Massachusetts. When I returned to New York to work and saw what had become of the Bronx, especially, you know, the Central City area and the main street in the Bronx is, of course, Jerome Avenue. When I saw what happened there, it reminded me of the pictures I saw from Detroit, which is it was a war zone. And
the other thing that happened in the Bronx is that many of the people who owned the buildings hired arsonists to burn the buildings. And then blamed it on the people in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
And because they wanted to collect the insurance on the buildings.
Yeah.
And so there was a lot of this destabilization. But the other important thing is that with this destabilization, other people came in who were real estate investors and started buying up this property at pennies on the dollar, knowing that these neighborhoods were going to be modernized in the future. And this has happened in black neighborhoods all over the United States in all urban areas.
Do you remember when back in the 70s, the image of the black man, the male, head of family, was no longer head of family? They remember when the show Beretta was on and they had this guy Huggy Bear, and we saw this image, and of course the movie Shaft gave you the same kind of image, where they were now they were platform shoe wearing pimps, and they were no longer, they did not ever characterized family life or family qualities in any important way. What they tried to do is make sure that the rest of the country saw this community as degraded by its own hand, if you will. And as a result of that, there was a shift in the way the non-black community saw the black community within the inner city. There was a lack of sympathy. It's their own fault kind of thing. We shouldn't feel bad for them. They're doing this to themselves. And, you know, your only job. And so all these kinds of things were undercurrents of belief systems that they were building. And they actually took hold. Because I grew up watching this stuff on the airwaves and in the movies. And they were very successful at shifting the public opinion, weren't they?
Well, of course. I mean, if you told people that that the Bush family were drug runners, they are not going to believe you. As a matter of fact, I heard last night on the radio that they're thinking about running another this other Bush brother who was the governor of Florida. They're talking about him perhaps running for the president of the United States in another 2 years. This is an extraordinarily intergenerational crime family, and yet who has been involved in the drug trade, and yet you people hold them up as if they are some kind of great family. And no matter what crimes they commit, whether it's lying the country into war, whether it's torturing people unnecessarily, whether it's running drugs, it doesn't seem to matter what this family does, because they are held up. Yet some black kid on the corner is the one who the other people will blame for this particular drug problem.
Well, here's the interesting thing that happens here in France, okay? The public policy here in France was to bring in a minority into the country back in the early 70s. Valerie Giscard d'Estaing brought them in and housed them in these chicken coops. But they all the families that came in, the father had a job, and they had great hope. They were being brought from a very poor country that had just been through civil war, which was Algeria, to a country like France that was on the upswing, and there were plenty of factory jobs. Anyway, my point being this, they built up their hopes. These people had families, children, they had jobs. All of a sudden, the bottom falls out of their financial strength, and they lose their jobs. The cities, these communities start going down the tubes by design. The prejudice within the French public is absolutely off the charts, so there's hatred against this minority. But this minority was invited in. They had terrible prejudice inflicted on them. They have no opportunities because of the conditions that are being set by this elite group. And now there is a polarization that has taken place by design. And I've watched it happen.
You know what, Daryl? I'm becoming immune to people, because this is the thing that is really interesting to me. The people on the lower levels of society are always fighting each other. They always find some reason to fight each other.
That's
and
right.
yet, they don't seem to be able to turn and look at what is really causing these problems to have them at each other's throats.
That's right.
So, I mean, why not continue to do it as long as people can't see it? And one of the things that I think is very important, because you talk about the banking system all of the time, is to really understand what drugs mean to the banking system.
Yep.
Because, you know, just in 2008, there was a headline to say that from the United Nations that during those times when the banking system was so unstable at that, in I think it was 2008, that the major liquidity in international markets was drug money.
Yep.
Now, so I think that people simply don't want to see that. I mean, how much more in your face could it be than a headline like that? And yet, people don't want to see how important drug money is to these societies.
Yeah. Yeah, and well, and anybody who's spoken about it either gets bought off or, deep sixed. And Maxine Waters, you would have thought that she was a good representative for her community. She may well have been when she started out. But in quite short order, after she brought up the fact that the CIA was flooding inner cities with drugs, she was forced to retreat from her positions. We got people like Rangel that have been bought off, people like Jesse Jackson never speaking out. Across the country, the spokespeople of the community most savaged by this have been bought off. And just like the rest of the country's politicians, all bought off. But they are allowed to make these mass fortunes. I'm talking hundreds of billions a year of clandestine money. And I want you all to know out there in the listening audience, and I'll mention this to Nancy again, we've talked about it. There are very strong ties to the Zionist Jewish community in all of these examples that we're giving now. The Kirchner family and the FARC. You see this guy Grasso in your book, a photograph of Grasso down at the in Colombia back after he left the
SEC.
Yeah, and he's down there talking to the FARC commander, which is the guy that's protecting the drug production down in South America.
In Colombia.
Yeah, and of course Bolivia is growing it, and Ecuador is growing it, and Colombia is growing it, and of course they're funneling it through Panamanian banks, which are all Zionist controlled, and into Miami, out to a cleansing point, whether that be the Caymans or another offshore, and then returning the money to the system, all cleaned up, tax free.
It's big money, and I think the other important thing is that people might be interested in knowing is that there also is a connection between a drug airport in Florida, Huffman Aviation, and Muhammad Atta, and the people who were claimed to be involved in 9/11.
Absolutely.
Muhammad Atta was somehow seemed to be involved in the drug trade in Florida, mm-hmm. and the airport that he and these other people were taking their flying lessons out of, it is a known narco airport.
Yeah, and we all know the story of MENA, where in fact the reason they selected the reason I got to say this, the reason Clinton went back to Arkansas was he was given that governorship. I mean, this is a guy. He's got a wife from Yale. He's gone to Yale. They've hatched a program and a policy while he's being a student that he's going to leave and take his show on the road to this place where they're going to do a lot of their drug distributing from. And of course, he's the governor, turns a blind eye to it. And a lot of the people who have brought these facts forward, a guy named Seal and others, have been either murdered, disappeared, or you know, whatever. But the fact of the matter is, that whole thing was a setup even before he became governor of Arkansas, in my view.
Yeah, the MENA, I don't know exactly the dates of the MENA, but I do know that he was governor when a lot of cocaine was being flown into Mina, and of course one of the pilots was Barry Seal.
Yeah.
But this stuff is going on to this very day. For example,
absolutely.
Again in 2008, a plane with a logo that looked very much like the logo from the Department of Homeland Security was busted in the Yucatan with hundreds of suitcases filled with cocaine. And the planes were traced back to owners here in the United States who have ties to the Republican Party. So when people think about drugs, they need to think about people like Clark Clifford.
Yes.
Clark Clifford who brought the BCCI, which was a major drug running bank, into the United States.
Yep.
Or they need to think about people like George Bush or Hillary Clinton or Bill Clinton. That's who you have to think about when you're thinking about the drug trade. You have to think about some of the most important elites in this country, or you have to think about Ben Bernanke or the people who are running the Federal Reserve. It's this, for example, the Wachovia Bank was just cited for money laundering, and they got slapped with a $160 million fine. But what does that mean if you're laundering billions of dollars of money?
That's right.
Nobody goes to jail for laundering this money.
No.
And so the major banks, almost every major bank in this country, whether it's Citibank or Morgan Stanley or Wachovia or Bank of America, all of them are laundering this drug money.
Well, the biggest bank, drug laundering bank in the world, is a filiale or a subsidiary to the Rothschild fortune. I brought up the name to you when we talked privately. It's called Santander. It is the fastest growing retail bank in Europe. They are doing, if you were here watching television in Europe, you would see advertising for change your account to Santander. We'll give you 100 euros if you sign up for our program. They'll give you 100 euros if you sign up. This bank out of Spain was a Latin American conduit drug bank for a very long time, and now they've made it mainstream. And it was nothing more than a laundering bank for out of Curacao and out of Miami and Panama. And it, as it turns out, it's now going to become the big hitter in banking in all of Europe. And seed money came from drugs.
But this is the question that the European community and the American community has to ask itself. And I found it fascinating. There's a woman by the name of Catherine Austin Fitz who used to be the undersecretary for HUD. And she also figured out about how the drug money is used in the society.
Yep.
And she has begun to talk about it. And she at one time, she was speaking, she continues to speak around the country. And she talks to people about how drug money impacts the culture, how it destroys communities. But at the same time, it keeps the stock market prices elevated because of the price. It helps to improve the price-to-earnings ratio, or what they call the POP, on the street. And so she was telling this story to a group of so-called spiritually minded Americans, and so she asked them, you know, are they more concerned with their 501ks and keeping the stock market elevated, or are they worried about getting rid of the drugs? And of course, only one hand went up for getting rid of the drugs. So you see, people are addicted to the drugs, not just the people who want the drugs, but the people who want the short-term gains. Because in the end, what these drugs are doing is really destroying Western civilization.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you make mention of the use of this as a tool of what they would call urban renewal. I would call urban destruction. They bring these drugs in. They unleash the poisons on the streets. They allow property values to fall and families to fall into ruin and infrastructure.
But they're doing the same thing to countries that they're doing to these communities.
That's right.
That's what's going on internationally
right now. That's right. That's right. It is international. But here's the problem. With the 401ks, as you mentioned, Nancy, the pension funds for those people who didn't put their hand up are being decimated anyway. And so, maybe the question she asked was a little premature. Now if they look at their 401k, they're not getting a kickback on it. I know people across America are absolutely gobsmacked by the looking at the lack of appreciation and in fact the shrinking of the of their pension fund. But what they don't realize is very shortly, in very short order, they're not going to have any value in that. And
no.
Because the criminals themselves are moving away from stock ownership into holdings, and the holdings that I'm talking about are they own everything, and this
yes.
is part of what they're doing with this implosion of the housing market. The, when these foreclosures go through, these homes across America and businesses and tracts of land and everything are being placed into the hand of the criminals, and America is going to be a nation without any ownership. They're not going to own anything that they have. It's all going to be owned by these criminals. And the financial system, the money system, will be replaced, but the ownership will be in the hands of these crooks. And that's
but
exactly
what you know what,
Daryl?
This is how I'm beginning to feel. If people don't wake up, then bully for these people. Because, you know, this is the, okay, they had the 1929 crash. Then they had the things that happened in the 80s, and then there were the dot-com bubbles. So people have had a long time to kind of look at this Federal Reserve and to see how this money thing is working. And still, they want to be in the dark. And so I don't know what's going to take to wake people up and to get them to begin to understand some just simple arithmetic. The arithmetic has to do with what they call usury or interest. You cannot charge somebody interest and expect the community to be stable over time, because at one point the interest is going to be so explosive that there's no way that you have enough assets to pay the interest back. That's how they're always going to be able to take what real assets there are in a community.
Well, the idea of inflation in itself is confiscative in the way it is used. In other words, if you want to liquidate or suck off all of the wealth of a nation or a system, you inflate it, and basically you hold the assets while the inflation process takes place, and you stop people from earning. And if you do those three things, you end up with ownership of everything. And so what you're going to have is masses of people looking for a place to park their tent very shortly. Now,
well, I think we need to, and I'm just going to mention this quickly because I know you have guests who are a lot smarter than me about the financial system,
mm-hmm.
but the idea of principal and principal plus interest over time, at one point it begins to explode exponentially, which it's doing right now. And once it gets to that exponential point, then that's sort of like when the Ponzi scheme happens and things begin to fall apart, and the people who are printing the money are and who don't do anything but print money and who don't put any value in the society end up owning everything in the society.
Well, now I'm to be fair, judicious use of credit, although I am not for the use of interest or compounding it and usury, and I'm not making that claim now, and I never will. But I'm going to tell you that it was not necessarily the limited use of credit, but the abundant use of it. The fact that you could go to a place like Las Vegas and see everybody. I remember the first time I went there, I couldn't find anybody that wasn't driving a brand new car. I mean, brand new. And everybody was living in a brand new shiny house, and everybody had a brand new this and a brand new that, and I was going in for a coffee, and everybody's wearing a Piaget watch or a Rolex, and, you know, and everybody's styling, and I'm looking around saying to myself, how could it be that a city would have all this wealth around? I couldn't believe. Well, they didn't. They just gave liberal credit terms to everybody, and they borrowed themselves into a morass, into a pit. And now that place has gone bust, and there are people walking around scratching the ground for food. Now, when I was growing up, of course, the kind of credit that people would be receiving would be time payment credit. Okay, in other words, for example, they would give you a couch in your house, and they'd say over the next 12 months you'd have to pay once a month. And I remember when I was a kid that a man would come once a month and come into the kitchen, and there would be a little cash given, and a payment would be made for that couch. And I'm sure there was probably a couple of quid extra for the right to buy it and the rest of it, but there was was no massive use of credit facilities to people. Why? Because that's a dangerous thing, and in every instance it's ever been used in history, it turned out badly. So what it was that growing up, Nancy, my parents had a lot of money, but they never had credit cards. They never had them.
Nobody had credit cards.
No. Did they use credit occasionally? Well, for some things they did. They did use credit to when they wanted to put an extension on the house and so forth. But it was done with great care, great judicious forethought. And it was used to really strengthen an asset that they had. Never for this, going on. There are people now that borrowed money to go on vacations and borrowed money to, you know what I'm talking about. Now, if I'm of the mind in my present life, and I have been for many years now, of the mind, that if I can't pay for it, I don't have it. And so, I mean, it's simple enough. If I can't, if I don't have the money for it, it doesn't happen. I don't have it in my life.
So, to get back to the medical issue of the immune suppression,
yeah.
Of course, this money, this opium issue and the money issue were big. But there were also other things that began to happen environmentally. For example, they started putting fluoride in the water. They started changing the way the food was grown and manufactured. They stopped allowing people to buy raw, unpasteurized milk. They took iodine out of the bread and started putting bromide in the bread. And so there were all these little tweaks that began, and then they started giving people many more vaccines. So there were all of these medical, environmental toxins that were also being promoted in the culture. And the other thing was the pharmaceutical drugs. Many of the pharmaceutical drugs were also being used inappropriately in certain communities. So by the 70s, you had this plethora of drugs and toxins and lifestyle changes that created this monstrosity of just a lifestyle that people begin to get sick. They begin to get sick because they were taking the drugs and they were not living a very healthy lifestyle. So when they showed up in the emergency rooms of the cities of New York and Los Angeles and San Francisco, instead of telling, and the first doctors recognized it as a toxic problem, but the CDC, always looking for a way to promote the FDA and to sell more drugs, decided that it was going to be a viral problem and rather than a toxic problem.
Yep.
And then they very quickly took a cancer drug that caused cancer off of the shelf and gave it to these very sick people. This drug, AZT, then began to really kill off people, and the AZT drug was promoted. People began to look at people losing weight and losing their hair and developing lymphomas. And that was the result of the AZT. It wasn't the result of this virus, but the image was put out into the community that these people were dying of this virus because that's what they wanted people to believe.
Well, we talked about in the last program, and anybody who wants to reference back to the last show we did, we talked about the homosexual community using nitrites and nitrates and different kinds of heavy toxic substances, plus lifestyle, plus, and then, of course, they were carrying a heavy toxic load. But there's also another thing that researchers have discovered, that our generation, yours and mine, we're victims of above ground nuclear testing, and we noticed that the cancer rates in the swath of land where the fallout was heaviest from the 1950s testing in Nevada test site have the highest rates of cancer. So what we saw already was that the base of the bodies of these people, the areas that these people lived in, were already toxified, and they already had mutations that were already fixed inside these people's bodies. And then once you add a toxic load to it, you have explosions of cancers and other things. So there's a whole bunch of stuff that went on all at the same time, Nancy. Yours and my generation, but mine probably a little more than yours, was absolutely poisoned completely. And I see every day when I go to my hometown newspaper, 50-year-old people that I grew up with are dying of cancer left, right, and center. I mean, I've lost dozens of people in the last few years of cancer.
Yes.
It's astonishing to read these. And I mean, even back in high school, I was losing friends with cancer. It's really amazing to see it. But so
yeah, given these little tweaks that they did, for example, the fluoride in the water, they took the iodine out of bread and they replaced it with bromide. They also started putting chloride in the water. And those halogens, those chloride, bromide, and fluoride replace a very important halogen, which is iodine. Iodine controls the master hormone, the thyroid, but it also is very important in the energy system of the body. So little changes, subtle changes like that, which are very difficult to pick up, would cause big explosions over time.
Yeah.
And of course, iodine deficiency is associated with prostate cancer, breast cancer, infertility, and all sorts of hormonal problems.
And what we were talking about, thyroid disease, either hypo or hyper, either being emaciated or overweight, caused because of your master gland, the thyroid, is not doing its work. It's not interacting with the other systems in your body, and all of a sudden, the problems you have begin to multiply. And once you're out of balance, Nancy, all kinds of problems begin to erupt. I mean, you fall victim not just to the what you would have from thyroid, but you're weakened. Your whole system is weakened, and you.
And this is the problem with the medical system, the way we were trained. For example, we're not really trained to really assess these small abnormalities. We're trained to give drugs, and so if someone comes in with a thyroid condition, we check their thyroid hormone status, and we might give them a thyroid hormone replacement. But most doctors will never check to see whether or not they may be iodine deficient, which may be the basic underlying problem.
Yep.
And that was the same thing with the people who had AIDS. Many of these people were deficient in a nutrient called glutathione.
Yep.
And other antioxidants. But those things weren't really being checked for in the broad swath, except outside of maybe the centers where they were doing studies. But the ordinary doctors weren't even told that these were issues in these patients. And so the patients were not being metabolically replaced.
No.
And that's the problem with almost every chronic health problem today.
Well, let's go
the
back.
Doctors are trained to give drugs, but they're not trained to actually stabilize the metabolic process.
Well, let's talk about the Flexner connection to rewriting allopathic process in medicine. You mentioned to me yourself in private calls about the lack of knowledge in the medical community about the nutrition. They gloss over it in medical school. It's like a 2-day coursework when in fact it should be one of the most important parts of your medical education. It's really just kind of fluttered over, and so most of these doctors aren't even trained in what kinds of problems erupt from these nutritional deficits. You want to talk a little bit about how the medical system completely ignores the importance of this when they're training you as a physician?
When we do learn biochemistry, and we do take biochemistry,
yeah.
But the problem is that we very seldom relate biochemistry to the metabolic abnormalities such as diabetes or hypertension. And what happens is that we study biochemistry, but once we get into our clinical rotations where we're learning how to take care of patients, it's almost like we forget the biochemistry that we've learned, and we simply start talking about, you know, this person has hypertension. hypertension, give them this drug, or this person has diabetes, give them this drug. I must say with diabetics, they do look at the diet a little bit more.
Yes.
But nutrition is not a course that's a normal course of any medical school. You can take it, at least when I was in medical school, and as I talk to my godson, who's in medical school right now, they still are not taking a nutrition course at his school. So it's something that you might take as an elective, but it's not something that's stressed at all in medical school.
And well, I mean, garbage in, garbage out, Nancy. I mean, it's true with computers. It's true with human beings. The fact of the matter is that there is no more important issue than what you put into your body. And we know full well that if they were to tell the truth about nutrition, then everyone would have to start looking at factory farming. They'd have to start looking at pasteurizing milk. They'd have to start looking at, again, bromiding the bread. And so, in other words, you can't teach that because people would be awakened to what they've done on a grand scale across the country. So, of course, they keep people away from those facts.
Yeah, also, I would also like people to be reminded that there's a bill, I think, in the Senate.
Yep.
It's S-510, and it basically is going to outlaw people from keeping seeds and growing gardens in their backyard. And if this bill passes, people are going to be criminalized for growing their own gardens. And it's going to have a terrible effect. You know, because one of the big movements in the United States right now is organic food, small
yes.
farmers,
yep.
and community gardens.
Yep.
And people are really spending a lot of money there. And of course, the Monsantos and these other large corporations, because they want to have the monopoly control of everything. And how they gain monopoly control is by controlling the laws that come out of Congress. They make it so complicated for small business people to really keep up with the prices that they have to pay for licensure that small business people end up going out of business because they can't keep it up. And so that's the problem with the nutritional market, and they're trying to do the same thing with farming right now. They're trying to just have total control of the farming industry put a lot of small farmers out of business.
The guy that just put in charge of the agricultural policy is a Monsanto. Yeah, I got that on the news section. I'm not surprised by any of that. What I am surprised about, and again, I talked about it with you also, and you already mentioned it. Fluoride is a powerful depressant of intellect and ability to really connect issues and problems. And Ireland was an example of this back in 1961. The entire nation switched its water system to 100% use of fluoride in all of the water. So,
and what year was that, Daryl?
1961.
Uh-huh.
Now, Ireland has a traditional background of resisting tyranny. They fight back. They fought the bloody British for 1,000 years. But since fluoride has come along, there has been a meek and mild response to every challenge. And I have to say, across America, 60 or 65% of the public water systems are laced with this fluoride. And now take a look at France. There's no fluoride in the water. And look how the French revolt against the government. And look what happens in America. I got to tell you that this fluoride connection has a lot to it. A lot to it.
Well, as fluoride was used historically to in bulls so that they could pacify bulls, and it certainly was used in the gulags and it's reported that the Nazis used it in concentration camps as well to keep the prisoners calm. And fluoride, of course, is that particular chemical is a part of many of the tranquilizers and things like Valium or Prozac.
Yep.
Have a halogen molecule, and they're known to be calming elements. So, but the other problem is that they also decrease the IQ as well. So,
yeah.
So people are not only calmer, they're not as smart. So they're not able to really connect the dots.
Is it true, Nancy, that if you stop drinking fluorinated water but continue to shower in it, does your body absorb the fluoride through your skin, which is your largest organ?
Well, actually, the showers are the worst. I mean, one of the things I do, I have a filter on my shower head. And I was made aware of that by a friend of mine who was a nutritionist and just recommended that, you know, the taking a shower every day is worse than drinking the water because your entire body gets saturated with it.
Yeah.
But it has fluoride. In the United States, the water has both fluoride and chloride.
Right.
So it has two halogen compounds.
Well, I also read some information about how saturated fats from animal fat mixed with chlorine or chlorinated water causes plaques in the bloodstream. And they said that the chlorine, the effect of chlorine on these fats is to cause a hardening of the fat within the walls of the artery. So what we might be finding here is that halogen chloride or chlorine, is one of the main causes for the heart disease or the huge number of heart disease cases we have. I don't know if that's true, but it was research done. And I mean, I don't have the background to substantiate it or not, but it's something I read and it makes sense to me.
Yeah, I've seen some literature with reference to that, but several things went up after they started putting fluoride and chloride in the water. We started seeing, as you said before, elevated levels of cancer, and we also started seeing elevated levels of heart disease. But what they try to do is to say, oh, the heart, because you have increased inflammation in the vascular system. So instead of dealing with this increased inflammation by removing these toxins, what do? They say, oh, it's cholesterol, and they put everybody on these cholesterol-lowering drugs. Then, of course, the cholesterol-lowering drugs reduce the amount of CoQ10 that you have, and so then that, which is a heart muscle stimulant, and so then people start dying of congestive heart failure. So it's just crazy. It's just crazy.
Yeah. Well, I want to move on to your main the main thesis within the book, which is the ultimate epidemic of malnutrition and toxicity that they have described or given the name AIDS to or HIV to, which is a fraud, and how this works into the geopolitical structure that they had brought forward in the 1980s and 90s, because they don't go to that. It's not their go-to plan anymore as much as it used to be, Nancy. But what did they use that for as a vehicle to what when they were doing it, aside from profits?
Well, the other thing is that it was very clear from Kissinger's National Security Memorandum 200 that they wanted to reduce the birth rate in Africa and some other developing countries, because they stated very clearly that having young people who wanted more from their life and who understood what was going on in their countries would be very damaging and to their geopolitical strategies, that they basically wanted they wanted the minerals and they wanted the resources that these countries had, and they didn't want to pay for them. And so they had a plan to reduce populations in these various countries. And so the AIDS is part of that psychology of population reduction. Now, the population of Africa has actually doubled in the last 25 years, but there's certain areas that they really want, and those areas they have attacked vigorously. For example, the Congo, especially the Eastern Congo, which has many of the minerals. For example, if you have a cell telephone or a computer, it has something called coltan. And so those areas have been depopulated and have been stigmatized. As a matter of fact, people are talking about the Sudan, but there have been almost 10 million people killed in the Congo over the last 10 years.
The Hutus and Tutsis, that whole thing, and this proof that has come out in kind of behind, you know, back pages of the press and so forth, that the French and the Americans knew darn well that the Hutus and Tutsis were going to murder each other, and in fact not only allowed it to happen, but in advance of it, certain things were done to make sure it did happen, and then they allowed
the
airway.
Paul Kagame was trained here in the United States at one of the military bases. So it's the same story, on and on and on. But the point of it is that they wanted to, if you want to create an image of a people and a continent that's in disarray. And what better image is to portray to the West is that these, you know, these African people who just can't get themselves together, and now they're so irresponsible that they're giving each other these sexually transmitted diseases and they're dying of AIDS. In the meantime, you can come in and steal all the resources, and people say, well, they don't need to have those resources anyway because they don't know what to deal with them. Then the other thing that happened in South Africa when the apartheid system fell apart is that the miners in South Africa had the possibility for the first time of suing Anglo-American mining company and these other gold extractive companies for the damage that was done to their lungs because of the silicosis and the asbestosis and the secondary tuberculosis that they developed in their lungs, which they took back to their communities. And now you have widespread tuberculosis in these poor neighborhoods. So, but instead, that what happened is that one of the economic hitmen, who's a Democratic fundraiser, Maurice Templesman, and also has been a hitman for the Oppenheimers for many years, was on the Harvard Public School of Public Health AIDS Committee. And so they immediately, when the Botha government fell, started saying that pulmonary tuberculosis was now a sexually transmitted disease. And that's when pulmonary tuberculosis became an AIDS-defining disease. And so these workers could no longer sue these companies for their injuries in the mine.
Well, let's talk about Maurice Templesman. He was the paramour of Jackie Kennedy, wasn't he? Not was he not?
Yes, Maurice Templesman is a big time. He's very wealthy. He was chosen when he was in his 20s to be the go-between between the Oppenheimers and the United States in terms of their the United States stockpile in diamonds. Because during the Second World War, the Oppenheimers were really holding out on the United States in terms of the diamonds that it needed for industry. And so the United States was determined that that was never going to happen again. But what happened is that they hired Maurice Templesman, and he, instead of the United States going trying to find another source of diamonds or finding the diamonds that they had in Arkansas, they started using these people again, the same people who had really tried to put the screws to the United States during the Second World War.
And those same people are the people that I rally against on a daily basis.
So at any rate, Templesman became a very powerful player in Democratic politics in the United States, and but he also has been involved in almost since the African countries have sought their freedom after overt colonialism. He was involved in the murder of Patrice Lumumba. He was involved in the overthrow of Kwame Nkrumah. He's been involved in coups and destabilizations of about 7 or 8 other African countries. So he is really, he really has played his hand in a way that has totally devastated the southern part of Africa.
And what we also know is that the West actually put Robert Mugabe in his place, and they have done a great job of depopulating Zimbabwe to move into the mining riches on these farms across Zimbabwe, because under the ground in Zimbabwe has much the same kind of mineral content as they found in just to the south in South Africa, and they needed to get rid of these populations, so they put a tyrant there. They kept saying that they didn't want him there, but they did absolutely nothing to get him out, because in fact he was their man. And of course they starved the people. They destroyed the country. They've decimated the population. If you live there, you probably moved already. And now that place is just perfect for ripe for the picking. Ripe for them to rape it. And in fact, they're starting to move equipment out of South Africa into Zimbabwe, the mining equipment, because the mines in South Africa are beginning to get played out. And now they've got a brand new place to go.
The gold mines in South Africa are just about done.
Well, and a whole host of different mineral types are starting to get more and more difficult to extract. So they're taking their machinery and their equipment, and they're moving into some pristine, depopulated places. And, you know, you tell somebody this, and it just seems so diabolical and so simple and diabolical that, you know, and then you'll get a lot of people go, yeah, so business as usual. Well, no, because now the victims are not just the minorities. The victims are all of us. They through these crimes and through these confiscations, they've actually they don't have racial barriers to confiscation anymore, Nancy. They don't have national barriers to confiscation anymore. They're doing it on a worldwide basis to everyone and anyone at will.
Well, you know, after Kennedy was killed, Malcolm X said the chickens have come home to roost.
Yep.
And I think that the people in the West were appalled because they had a hard time really understanding what he was trying to say. But that's what he was trying to say. He was trying to say that we're all, you know, the way this thing is working, it's a global issue.
Yep.
And they're doing it through the financial system. And for people to really resist that idea is naive. And it's going to be destructive.
Yeah. We talk about these things almost as though they're happening in a vacuum. Well, they're not. The history proves it. People have written about it. You've studied it. I've talked about it almost daily on my programming. The fact of the matter is we're in an endgame situation here for the rest of us. If we don't stand up now, Nancy, I have fear that the technology will permit these people to have a force multiplier on us. And we will have control grids structured around the world where we don't have the capacity to resist. And so I think we're at a point right now where this is a last-ditch effort for us to really mount a resistance against this crime wave. And I'm wondering your take on what I just said, and if you believe what you think we need to do here.
Well, you know, one of the things I said, Daryl, one of the most important things I think is that you're doing, you're trying to educate people. And people need some basic education very quickly because they have to understand what's happening. But more than that, they have to have a vision for the future, because I'm not hearing that people are trying to have a vision for the future, and a future without this kind of banking structure and this kind of damaging structure where people are bent on destroying the earth and destroying each other rather than on supporting the best the human could be. So I think we need to ask ourselves, what do we need to do individually to resist this system, but at the same time to develop our awareness so that we don't fall prey to this system? And we have to start thinking globally, and we have to start thinking globally as well as locally. One of the things I think in the United States is, and I heard one of your speakers the other day say that one of the things that happened in Argentina when the banking system began to fall apart is that very quickly communities developed some kind of means of selling.
Yes.
And they had monetary systems, and as soon as the banks came in to stabilize the system, they got rid of those things. And I think that that if things fall apart, we actually have an opportunity to develop a new banking system and a new way of thinking. And the other thing I want to say is this, because the West was founded on a religion, and people are getting away from the religion. You don't have to be religious, but you need some sort of spiritual character. You need some sort of anchor, because we're not just five sense beings. And if people don't develop some kind of anchor beyond commercialism and consumerism, then we're all going to be in trouble.
Yeah, I agree with that. Our moral compass is broken beyond recognition, but that doesn't mean all of us have not recognized that, because you mentioned it yourself. Toxicity actually blinds you to your role in as a human with other humans. I mean, you kind of see yourself as an island out there rather than as a part of a race of humans trying to enjoy themselves, better their families, better their lives. We've lost our connection from all of the grand circus and the rest of it, Nancy. But we can regain that. You know, there was a time I thought, you know, the right suit or the right watch or the right car or the right thing or the right, you know, house or the right neighborhood. All of these things would, or right education even, is going to give me my passport to happiness. And of course, now that I'm in my 50s and I have learned what I've learned, I realized that the things that actually bring you happiness, you can't buy. You can't pay for them. You have to develop them. You have to cherish them. You have to nurture them. And those are the kinds of things that we all have to turn to. And it's about community. It's about sharing. It's about volunteering. It's about, you know, all of the things that are not able to make a profit on. Those are the things we need to start really developing in our lives. I did a whole show on it recently because it was so, it's such an important issue. And I'm not getting soft on the issues here. This is something that we have to develop in order to be strong against this crime wave. And we've come down to now to about an hour and 13 minutes on this broadcast, which is about the end of it. I want to give you the last word. We didn't finish everything in the book, and I hope we can do one more visit to the book. I want to tell everybody that this book is an incredible read, Nancy. I've recommended it. I've heard back from a lot of people who bought the book. They are really impressed by your work through the history and through the connections, and you know it's in keeping with the things I've taught over the last few years on my broadcast and on my website, but it's a good read because again I've said this a dozen times in with you on air, the writing style is very conducive to sitting through the work. I mean, you know, this is some hard stuff we're learning here. And if
the name of the book is AIDS, Opium, Diamonds, and Empire. And the one thing, yeah. The one thing I've learned from medicine is that you need to have a holistic approach to the person who's sitting in front of you, yeah, as a physician. But you also need to have a holistic approach to the world, because the truth of the matter is everything is interconnected. And one of the ways we've been made to be ignorant of ourselves and our history is that things are separated. This, you know, the Second World War was here and Vietnam was here and these were different events. But when you start looking and you follow the families and you follow the timelines and you follow the money, you see that these are not different events. They're just continuations of the same process. And I think I would like people to start looking at history as a process rather than a series of events.
I agree with you completely. And I also want people to understand that sharing giving of yourself, whether it be in the process of educating people about these facts or strengthening your family ties or starting to do things geopolitically or politically in your communities, these are gifts you're giving to your children and your grandchildren, but to each other as well. We don't have the option of sitting back and letting others do it, Nancy. We have to do it ourselves. And so my urging is that you take you get this book and you share it around. I mean, buy a copy and let your wife read it. Let your brother-in-law read it. Let your son read it. And continue the research. My website has dozens of other books that bring history to life for you as well and how we got to where we are. It's important that we do all of these things. And again, the book is AIDS, Opium, Diamonds, and Empire, The Deadly Virus of International Greed by Nancy Turner Banks, MD. My friend, I'm very proud of you, Nancy, for having written this book. I am. I'm proud to call you my friend. You're a great resource and you're a wonderful person to know. You're very busy and you got a lot going on, but you know what? We've always got time to jawbone about some issues that I think are critical. We got such important stuff going on in this world, and you're right in the thick of things, and I'm proud to know you.
Thanks, Daryl. And the other things I'd like to say for people and you know this well, you know, without your health, you really can't do anything. And so I'd like everybody to understand that there are some simple things that we can all do to make sure that our health improves and stays stable.
Absolutely. Ladies and gentlemen, that's Nancy Turner Banks, and I want you to all know that there will be another one more story about this book. We're going to actually field questions from you. I'd like you to email either Nancy or myself. You can, Nancy, give your email, not your email, your website address, please.
Yeah, if they can go to nancybanks.us, nancybanks.us, and they can contact me through my site.
And there is a link on Nancy's name. If you click on it, it'll bring you to her website. Actually, when you click on her name, it brings you to the Amazon webpage to get her book. This time on her name, I will put her website on this particular interview. I do hope we do one more, Nancy, to talk about this, because there's so many more issues we could bring up. Today was about the drugs and so forth, but there are other things in the book that need to be talked about as well. Ladies and gentlemen, until the next time, this is Daryl Bradford Smith telling you all, please take care of your families and be well. Bye-bye now.